welcome back to Katie's Crib. In this episode, we are talking about some of the challenges of raising a kid today in this rapidly changing world, and how we can prepare our kids to be the best human beings possible. How can we raise our kids to be good citizens who look out for one another and respect each other? Essentially, we're talking about the values that we are passing down to our kids so they can help make our world a better place. My guests on today's episode are Michael Skolnick, a civil rights activist, and Paola Mendoza, a filmmaker, activist, and author. Paola and Michael are both co-founders of the Soze Agency. They're partners and parents to a six-year-old, and they joined us by phone from New York. Super technologically advanced, you guys. I can't imagine two better and amazing people to talk with about this vital and important topic. So let's get started. We are here with two people I am so excited to be talking to, Michael Skolnick and Paola Mendoza. Thank you guys so much for being on my podcast.
Our pleasure.
First things first, can you guys talk about some of the incredible work you do independently and together?
Yeah. Paola, you want to talk about your work?
So I am an artist. I'm a filmmaker and a writer. I make both documentary and narrative films, and almost all of my films deal with immigration. I've been making movies about immigration for the past essentially 10 years. In 2016, obviously Donald Trump is elected to be president. And what happened at that moment of his election is that I decided that I needed to take my art and combine it more, work within the realms of activism in a much more concrete way. My films have always been socially conscious and dealing with political topics, but I really wanted to use my art to be in direct response to the current political climate. And so what that turned out to be is that I was one of the co-founders of the Women's March, as well as the artistic director of the Women's March. Wow. And I worked with the Women's March for the first 6 months after the March on Washington. And then I decided to move into my own space, my own work, focus back on immigration particularly, and everything that was at the intersection of art and politics. And so what that has turned out to be is a variety of different things that I call at this moment the creative resistance. I was working at the front lines of family separation.
Wow.
In 2018. And then also I was with the caravan for the past. I went to the caravan on November 1st and went back and forth through the month of December, and have been doing a lot of work with those that are asking for asylum in the United States. But specifically, again, it goes always back to how does art work in this space? So I'm not necessarily doing work on a policy level. I'm really looking at narrative change and narrative shift and narrative building at this moment within the immigration space. And so that coincides a lot with the work that Michael does specifically at we have a creative agency, which is called Soze. And so I do a lot of the immigration work there and a lot of the work around feminism with feminism and women and the current political climate. And then Skolnick, you want to talk about Soze as a whole?
Sure. So I had a long conversation this morning with a new friend about fatherhood and about manhood. And I think at the core of our life's journey has been centered around compassion. And as we talk about our son, certainly there are many, many tales of that he has told us that make us proud to be his parents. When he talks about the compassionate heart that he has. And so how do you build a compassionate business? How do you build a compassionate company that not only practices a set of values in the outside world, but also practices a set of values internally in the company? So we built a creative agency. We only do things that we truly, truly believe in. We don't chase money. We have a triple bottom line: people, planet, and profit, and people and planet coming first in that order and for that right reason. And we're also a workers-owned cooperative. So Paola and I are giving the company away over the course of 7 years. We've given 62% of the company to the workers and really trying to build equity with women and people of color who so often don't get a chance to own something, especially companies. And so as a white man, I know you can't see me, but as a white man who has consistently been given opportunities, oftentimes not well-deserved, mm-hmm. I thought it would be an interesting experiment of could we create a compassionate capitalistic company that is a for-profit business. We have no debt. We have no investment. We're doing it all by ourselves as a group of young people putting a company. And we have now 7 owners. Anyone can become an owner after 1 year being in the company. And we get a chance to work with some of the most amazing movements and companies and nonprofits in the world that are trying desperately to hold on to, you know, compassion, as Paola mentioned, during a very, very tough political time in this country, where compassion seems to be a commodity that is being challenged.
Yes. How old is your son?
He'll be 6 in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
You guys work so much in these causes, and do you find yourself having just open lines of dialogue with the 6-year-old about what's going on in the world? Or I feel in some ways like, oh, thank God I have a 16-month-old and I don't have to put on the TV and see X, Y, and Z. You know, we're doing no screens, so that sort of lines up. But like, you are running into the fire of what's going on right now in this political climate. How do you talk to your son about it? Like, I'm so scared, and that's probably not the best way to be, but I have a lot of friends who their impulse is to turn off the news, step away from social media, basically disengage with the so-called negativity, but maybe that's not the best. That's not good. What do you guys think?
You know, Mateo, that's our son's name. Yes. Mateo lives in a political household. Mm-hmm. Michael and I are talking politics nonstop. We're talking about current events as a family. And so we do talk about these subjects in front of Mateo, but we talk about them with him as well. We talk about them in a way in which obviously a six-year-old can understand, but we definitely, when family separation was happening, I was talking to Mateo about family separation, mm-hmm. about why mama was working so hard, why mama had to go to X place or to that place, or even, you know, why mama was crying sometimes, and explained to him what the situation was. I think that at the very least, you know, our son, though he is a son of an immigrant, is going to come up in a very privileged atmosphere in New York City. Mm-hmm. His parents own their home. He will come away in life with physical wealth and legacy. And he is going to have so much privilege in his life that what I, as a mother, what we as parents have to be able to do is at the very, very least have conversations with him of difficult subjects. Because the reality is that 6-year-olds are physically being torn away from their parents and they have to live through that. So how can I as a mother not at the very least have the conversation about the reality of what is going on in this world? And, you know, as Michael said earlier, the most important thing that we can do as parents is to raise a compassionate boy.
Yeah, this
will then
is...
become a compassionate man. And in order to do that, he has to understand the realities of what is going on in the world today. And obviously, again, we're talking about it from the perspective of a 6-year-old.
Right.
Just 2 days ago, I went to speak at Mateo's school about the caravan and immigration. And I'm able to talk about it in a place for 6-year-old children to understand, but we are talking about war and refugees and poverty and immigration. And I think that that's the very least that we can do for our children.
The one thing I'd just add, Katie, when we look at children, there's the external sort of what is happening in the world and how is it happening around them? And how do we engage with our children on those kinds of sometimes very challenging discussions? But there's also the internal development of your child. And I would challenge parents who are listening to this, that your child from the moment I've watched this now, I've had a front row seat to the human development of a 6-year-old that has been remarkable to watch. Remarkable to see how he experiences things from his eyes and his perspective, but also how damaging sometimes what he experiences can be to his development. And specifically talking about race and gender, how young boys specifically are raised in this country begins from day one, not from when they turn 5 or 10 or 15 when they're teenagers, but from day one. how your child sees colors, how you teach your children colors, which colors you describe to your child are masculine or feminine.
Yeah.
You know, we have people in our family who, you know, some boys like blue, some boys like pink. But our child, you know, and most children, most boys are taught that blue is for boys and pink is for girls.
Right.
What does that do to the development of a child? We talk about race. If our child does watch TV and does watch screens, does look at screens, if our child is consistently looking at television where the dark character is bad and the light character is good, Star Wars as an easy example that we all can understand and relate to, how does that child then walk down a city street or a rural street or a suburban street and see a person of darker skin complexion, a black or brown person, and look at that person as a good person, right? So we have taken the approach that our child's development, if you took Harvey Weinstein's parents at our age and said, do you foresee Harvey Weinstein at 60 years old being charged on rape and sexual assault? I think that mother would say, of course not. My child is going to be amazing. So none of us can predict that a child would do bad things or hurt people or have racist thoughts or sexist thoughts or homophobic thoughts. But so many parents who do a good job, their children do end up that way because of other things that are coming into their lives that are not dealt with by their parents and by people who love them or their guardians, people who take care of them. So we've taken the approach that every single day we have to do the work, especially for a young boy who is taught so often to be aggressive or violent or disrespectful towards women or not, or feel superior, and especially towards a young white perceived child. Yeah. And when it comes to race in the same way. So when, you know, our child said to us a week, 2 weeks ago, there was a soft lockdown at his school.
I want to hear about this.
The police came.
Yes, right? Yes.
And there's a soft lockdown at his school. And your listeners may not know, but we've had the great honor and privilege to work and advise and counsel the students from Parkland, Florida. And we took them on a tour that we helped produce this summer of 60 cities around the country, and many of which Mateo joined us on that tour. So he knows the students, right? He knows the young people from Parkland. He considers them his quote unquote friends.
Yes.
So this lockdown happened at his school. We get a text message, it's a soft lockdown. The parents are getting very scared and nervous. They're asking a lot of questions. Mateo comes home from school that night and he says, you know, the soft lockdown. And they explained, then they had to explain to him what a hard lockdown is. So a soft lockdown is stay in your classroom, don't leave. Something's happening in the school. We don't really know what it is. It's some police activity. A hard lockdown is an active shooter, right? Or something as bad as that. And the hard lockdown, close the window shades, don't move, hide in the corner, don't speak. So explain that to these 5 and 6 year olds in kindergarten. Now, this is not something they shouldn't explain to them because we know in Sandy Hook, 5 and 6 year olds were murdered just a few years ago. So this is an issue that 5 and 6 year olds sadly have to deal with in this country. So he comes home that night, he explains to us what happened in his school. The next day he wakes up and he says to me, Daddy, I want to write a letter to my teachers. I said, great, let's write a letter. So he's dictating a letter to me that I'm writing in his room. And the letter says, Dear so-and-so and so-and-so, his two teachers. And he says, thank you so much for taking care of us and loving us during the soft lockdown. I have friends who went through a hard lockdown, Emma, David, Cameron, Jackie, so on and so on. Mm-hmm. The students from Parkland. Loved Mateo. So he knows that those students in Parkland, Florida, who he has a personal relationship with, lost their friends.
Yeah.
And had a school shooting. I can't hide that from a 5-year-old anymore because kindergarten classes are getting shot up in America.
Yes.
So if I hide that from my child, when a hard lockdown happens, he may think it's a joke. He may do the wrong thing. He may run outside the hall and he may get hurt himself. So none of us as parents ever want our children to get hurt, ever want our children to hurt somebody. But with this environment that we are in this country, this is not just a Trump problem. This is a long-term challenge we face for decades and sadly centuries in this country. But for this environment in this country, we've taken the approach to be brutally honest with our child and to answer the easy and tough questions. He came home a few weeks ago and said, fucking shit. And instead of saying, don't say fucking shit, well, who told you that? What kid at school? Well, let's talk about what fucking shit means. So when you stub your toe, you can say fucking shit. That's okay. But don't say to your teacher it's fucking shit. Right? So,
my kid's going to be like, I learned fucking shit from my mother. Oh, God. Exactly, I'm like, terrible. Exactly,
right? So we just, you know, we're not like the PC police that I think a lot of people want to talk about. It's like, it's just honesty and transparency with your child, because we feel, and if you don't, like shit happens and you said, I never saw that coming.
Right.
And I would just add to this, I think with the honesty and transparency, the other thing that we constantly offer to Mateo is how he can change things. So, and that means Mateo showing up to marches. The first march that Mateo went to, he was 7 months old. It was a Black Lives Matter march in New York City. Went out and we went several times to various marches in New York City around Black Lives Matter, going to the March for Our Lives march. He was there. He heard all of those stories around family separation. We did a video for the kids who were being separated, and he went, he said what he wanted to say to the kids. And so it's constantly giving them the reality of the world, but then also empowering them to be actively engaged in the way that they can be engaged and that they have the ability to change things should they not like it. Mm. And I think that's really important too, is the tools to change things and allowing that's them right. to engage in those tools.
Yeah, giving them the opportunity
they possibly can.
Giving them the opportunity that they're not yes. too, yeah, like getting it out of that's your head right. that they're too small to do something or to understand right. something or... it's better to just protect them and keep them in the dark.
Let me ask you a question if I can.
Yes,
when
please.
You were pregnant with your beautiful child, did yes. you play your child music?
All the time. And I went to so many marches with him in my stomach.
Amazing. Did you talk to your child?
Of course.
Right? So those are beautiful things that we're taught to do when we're pregnant with our children. And then somehow when the child comes out, right, we don't think, everyone says the child forgets everything before they're 5 years old. That's what people tell you. Right?
Yeah. Yep. I've heard that.
Right. But your child's developing their personality before they're 5 years old. They're not developing personality when they're in your womb, which is yeah. why you talk and play music. All these things happen. So from day one, play your child music, talk to your child, take them places that you think that will matter to your child when they're 7, 10. Or 15, when they can remember those things. Mateo went to Italy last year. The only thing he really remembers from Italy is two things. One is that he got a gladiator costume when he went to the Colosseum.
Awesome.
Awesome. And two, that he gave the extra fish that we took home from the restaurant to some guy in the street who was hungry. Mm. That's it. So he'll hold on to those two little memories. One is that he loves to, you know, play with his gladiator costume. And two is that he felt compassionate and gave his fish away to the homeless man on the street. So we, from day one, we've just like covered him with love, shown him as much we possibly can. And also respecting, as Paola said, she spoke to these young kids 2 days ago. They're still five, right? So how we speak is still to a five-year-old.
Of course, of course.
Speaking to him, he's 15. But treating him like he's, you know, he's old enough to understand the things that we're doing. Mm.
I want to talk to you guys. You guys both touched on this separately, and I'm very – this is huge to me. In how to raise a good citizen, I also more specifically want to raise a feminist son, and I want to avoid him falling into the grips of the toxic masculinity. And I feel like the two of you guys, given all the work you do, I think – you've really touched on this compassion thing, but I remember when I got pregnant and I wanted a girl so bad and I found out I was having a boy and I was so horrified. And I told Shonda, my boss, who, and she was just like, yeah, that's a real job to do. Raising a perceived white dude in this society is a real job. Do you guys tell me about how you guys are doing? Tell me the advice you got.
I'm not sure how we're doing, but we're definitely trying our best. And I had a similar experience when I was pregnant and I found out it was a boy. I was like, oh my God, I know how to raise a girl.
Yep.
Like I totally understand how to raise a girl. I have no idea how to raise a boy.
I felt the same way.
I don't know. It hadn't occurred to me that I might have to.
Me too.
One day. And I was really freaked out. And then after I got freaked out and I was like, okay, well, I have to do it. I also, and this is important because in my family, there wasn't a lot of men, but I realized, oh, like I'm not in this alone. I actually have a man with me that was raised as a turned out to be a great man, a compassionate man, a feminist
man.
So I think that is important.
Who is this that you speak of?
Yes. Not you. So I think that that is important of in the case of us, like Matteo has a really great role model. And so there's practical things, obviously, just as simple as, and this happened very soon when Matteo started going to school, when he came home and he said, "Mama, you can't do that because you're a girl." Mm. And I was like, but then what I try to do, what we try to do is ground things in real life examples for Matteo. So Matteo's a mama's boy. And so when he said that to me, you know, I broke it down of like how hurtful that was to me because I am a girl and took him through all of the steps, right? And at the end of it, he seemed to understand what we were talking about. And I haven't heard him say that again without him correcting himself.
Nice.
Right? Which I think is very important that he's able to be conscious enough to correct himself. And I also think it's examples, real life examples of like things that are as simple as how we run the household with regards to who's cleaning up what and who's cooking what. Mm. You know, Michael laughs at me all the time, but I'm very much the person that's like, "Oh, I washed dishes last time. Now it's your time. Now your turn." He's like, and he jokes. It's like, "You keep counting." I'm like, "Yeah, I actually do." Because that's a way in which to make sure that we are dividing that housework as equally as possible.
Yep.
Because or else we fall into these traditional gender roles that I'm constantly trying to push through and break through. And so I think Matteo sees that. He knows that mama works. He knows that dada works. And Michael's always really good about making sure that it's not just daddy's going to work, that mama's going to work too. And so I think it's partnership, it's honesty, it's trying to lead by example, and it's giving them real life examples when they see it. And when they make mistakes, correcting them in ways where they're not afraid to make a mistake. And I think that's the difficult situation that we're in at this moment, is that people in general in society are very afraid to make a mistake as they're unlearning toxic behavior. Mm. So when men are unlearning toxic masculinity, they have to be able to be given the space to fuck up and to be retaught and move forward. And they need to have that safe space in order to do that. The same thing with race. Folks, and it's hard and it's exhausting for those, for women, for people of color, for Black folks to be allowing folks in their learning space to be able to learn and fuck up. But I think that is the only way that we're able to move forward.
Yeah, you can't learn unless you fuck up. You know, it's like you fuck up and then, and I mean, it's one of the many tools.
Fuck up, right?
Yeah, you don't want to fuck up big.
He fucked up.
No, yeah. But if you do small fuck ups, it's like that's an opportunity. I think people fuck up and they don't, you know, they miss the opportunity to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously. Have you guys made a concerted effort with your son to talk about how to treat others or how to treat girls or general conversations with him about consent? I mean, he's almost six, so that's probably, I mean, I'm guessing that's young for that, but maybe not.
Michael had a conversation with him about consent that I wasn't aware of that Matteo talked to me about. So Michael,
ooh,
you can delve into
do
that.
Do tell.
Yeah. You know, I think your friend Shonda is probably pretty smart. She probably she's probably pretty successful and has a few things.
Yeah, you could maybe say that.
Right? So, I don't know her, but she seems like a good person.
So
I think what Shonda says is right, is really right, is that this is every day. And sadly, for most of us, it wasn't every day for whoever we were raised by, and not necessarily just our parents or their guardians, whoever was in the house. And that we're having, as Paola and you were just discussing, we have to unlearn all these things that we were told were true. We were told that the reason why Black people were poor, or some are poor, is because they don't work hard. Mm. And we believe that as white people. Like, we genuinely believe that to be true. We were told that women did not want to go to work and they just wanted to stay home and take care of their kids. And we generally believe that to be true as men, right? So we then said, oh, well, the role of a woman is to stay home and the role of a woman is to be in the kitchen, right? We use that kind of toxic language. And so for me as a 40-year-old man, I have to do the work every single day to unlearn the things that I have been taught that hold me down like cancer, right? And so this isn't a Democrat Republican issue or right left or rural suburban. This is a gender issue, a race issue that crosses all political affiliations, all economic statuses, and all geographical locations. So for our child, I'm so fascinated by what he's taught and then how he processes those things. And so I have taken the approach of like, just forget the results, focus on the process. Because the result, no one is going to tell us that our child is going to turn out to hurt somebody, whether murder somebody or rape somebody.
Oh God, like, I keep going back to Weinstein as a kid. And I mean, could you ever imagine like what? I mean, yes, you're right.
At some point he was a child, and it's unfathomable to believe that about your own child, because you think your child is special and great as well as you should. But if you don't do that work every single day, so the conversation that we had about consent was, you know, he told me that some boy in his class kissed some girl.
Okay.
Right. And that I was like, well, how did that happen? Was she okay with that? Did she want to be kissed? And we started talking about, you know, asking for permission. And what does permission mean? And I don't know the science. You know, Pal and I met in theater school. So take whatever I say, at least she's much smarter than I am, but I was a theater major. So take whatever I say and, you know, you probably should Google it, but I can only imagine the science behind a child who has behavioral issues at a younger age, you know, how that child develops differently than a child who may or may not have done something at a younger age. And if it's not corrected or course corrected at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, you see boys at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old do things that like, damn, who's teaching that child?
Yeah. Like what the hell is that?
You know,
yeah.
What, how did that happen? How did that kid just, you know, grab that girl and push her down? And so, you know, and I think for Mateo, I think is important for parents who sort of have, who also want to live their lives. Right? I told Mateo when he was born in the hospital, I looked at him, I said, Mateo, I want to be proud of you as my son, but I also want you to be proud of me as your father. And so for us, he also knows that, you know, when I go to school, the teacher said to me last week, he's like, you have I joke with the kids, I got nicknames for all of them. There's Malcolm, I call him Malcolm in the middle. There's Mo, I call him Mo Better Blues. I got nicknames for all of them. So the teacher's like, damn, you know all the kids. And so Mateo knows that, like, we believe that we got to take care of all of our children, not just our own. We love our own. He's our cub, right? We want to hold him close. But also, like, if we see something that is not cool, like, we tell Mateo, like, daddy's going to say something, mommy's going to say something, because we want all the kids to also have a chance, not just Mateo. And that's what Hala discussed, this privilege point. We know our kid has a lot of access, of wealth.
Yes.
You know, and so we want him to understand that, and that some kids in his class, you know, when we have, you know, every week they have a parent gathering with the kids, and like some kids never get their parents to come. And we've discussed why those parents couldn't come, or why the grandparents couldn't come, because he doesn't understand that, you know, some kids don't have the same kind of abilities that he has, or access or privilege. So, yeah, we have, you know, I'm probably the bad example because I have, you know, and Paola does too, but I just speak for myself. I have really honest conversations with Mateo. It's a total fucking experiment. It could all go over. I'm not saying take my advice.
It is not going to go wrong.
Yeah, I don't think so.
It's just an experiment, and it's an everyday experiment.
No, I think it's really good. Mm-hmm. And we joke, you know, like when we were pregnant, you know, my husband would say, do you think if I never turn the TV, you know, we have a photo, this is like amazing, but we have a photo of me and Michelle and Barack Obama in our kitchen. And Adam's like, do you think if it's lying, if we point to that picture and say, that's the president. And then it's like, and we never turn on the TV. And by the time this is all over, you know, he'll be 3 and it will never have happened. And, you know, it's like, these are the jokes we were saying, and I really don't think, you know, that that's great either. And so I'm just fascinated by how you guys are doing this. I feel like I think it's really important for parents to hear this option, because I do think we hear a lot about, you know, just hiding the truth or, you know, looking the other way, or it's, you know, it's not really there if we don't pay attention to it. But like, it's here. And I don't think, like you said, I don't think it's ever too young to have these conversations in a 6-year-old fashion, you know, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever too young. Michael, did you feel that Mateo was able to understand, like, permission? Did the girl say that it was okay that she got a kiss, or was it?
I think the start of something. I can't say he understood it. In the same way that he told me when they discussed Black Lives Matter at their school, I said, tell me what Black Lives Matter is. He said, well, some Black people wanted to have lunch at a diner and the white people were very mean to them, wouldn't let them have lunch. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's Black Lives Matter? He's like, yeah, that's Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, that's a good start. Yeah. We'll start with something. So I think it's a start, and I think it's an ongoing conversation.
But I will say this. Yeah. I think because Mateo, again, I wasn't there for that conversation, and Mateo brought it up to me. Michael wasn't in town when he brought it up to me, right? So it was in his mind. It like stuck. It's a seed. And I think that's what's really important, is what we're doing at this age is planting various seeds. Mm. And we, with experience and with moments as life is lived, get to water those seeds. And we get to water the plant that we want to grow, because society is watering the other plant and they're watering it nonstop, right? The other seed, and that plant is growing, but we have the ability to grow the plant that we want. And so the same, like, again, like, he goes to a very progressive school, obviously, if you haven't figured it out, but they brought up, he brought up to me the other day, the idea and the concept of transgender. Mm. And, you know, that was something that I was unsure of how to broach and approach as a parent, how to take that concept in and explain it to my child. And in our family, we have someone that is experimenting with their sexuality, potentially, possibly. And so it's something that I'm very aware of to talk about with Mateo. And, you know, he explained to me, again, the seed that was planted in him is he said that in school they told him, sometimes you're born in the body of a boy, but inside you're a girl. Mm. And sometimes you're born with the body of a girl, but sometimes you're a boy inside. Mm. And I was like, okay. And then what happens? And he was like, I don't know. And that was, you know, that's like the first step.
Yeah, you're planting. I love that. I think you're planting a lot of seeds that will grow. Do you guys, I know you said you're at a progressive school, and Michael, you grew up in New York, and Paula, you grew up in Columbia. I grew up in New York also, and I am very afraid. LA is very segregated into neighborhoods, and I grew up in a place where I saw people that looked different every day, all day. And in LA, in the neighborhood we live in, you could go weeks without seeing a Black person or a transgender, you know, like, you can't, it's people very, they look similar. And so, you know, I have a group of mom friends now who are, you know, we were in a Mommy and Me class, and the teacher was going on about how it's important to have maybe dolls that are different colors, or you, I mean, of course, I'm making a huge attempt of bringing my child into many different experiences. But for people that aren't fortunate to, like, live in a place that looks like New York, which is rare. I mean, a melting pot like that is rare. Do you have any advice for me on what you would do in my situation? I mean, it's real. Like, when you go to tour nursery schools in LA, I mean, it's people of different races live in different places. Like, that's how it is
right
here. And I think it's how it is in most places in this country. In this country. Or I remember the first books that were given, one of our best friends, a Black man, gave us a book, and he was like, this is like one of the few books I could find where there were babies and parents on all the pages that were different colors because they don't exist. And so how do you start these seeds with a 16-month-old when even the books he's looking at don't have babies that look different from him? Or, you know, these are the things that keep me up at night.
They're real things. They are real things. And there's things that keep us up at night too. Like the reality is yes, New York City in general is a melting pot, but New York City has the most segregated public schools in the country. Mm. New York City public schools are more segregated than they are. They're more segregated now than they were before Brown versus Board of Education. Mm. And that's the reality of New York City public schools. And Mateo goes to a public school. So, as we mentioned before, our neighborhood is right next to, so our apartment is a very nice, expensive neighborhood now. We've lived here for a very long time. But right next to our, literally right across the street from our apartment, there are projects. And so lots of projects. And so our neighborhood also is the mixing point of class diversity and racial diversity. Mm. And it's something that, you know, again, we talk about it with Mateo, and there's also a homeless shelter right down the street from us. So we have a lot of homeless people in and around our neighborhood. And so I think I say all of that to say that the reality of race is real and also something that needs to be discussed and to be talked about. I know that parents of children who are not black or brown, so essentially white parents, want to live in this bubble I've experienced that they don't want to talk about race because they don't want to quote unquote point out the differences essentially between white kids and black kids and white kids and brown kids. And they want to allow the kids to remain as innocent as possible, mm-hmm. For as long as possible, mm-hmm. the innocence of being blind to race. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think that is...
not the way to go.
That's a privilege to be able to do that.
Right.
Because white kids don't have to deal with race.
Right.
Mateo's cousin is black and Jewish. And they've had to have the black conversation with his cousin very early on. Mateo presents as white. He walks on the street and he looks white, though he speaks Spanish and comes from an immigrant household. We haven't had to have the conversation of what it means to be black in this country from a personal experience, but we have had it in the relationship to what is going on, and specifically with regards to his cousin, because he loves his cousin, right? And so the idea of bringing books into the household is super important, and dolls, and also making the effort to go into other neighborhoods where other children are to take them to extracurricular activities. You know, one of the stories that I am most proud of with regards to Michael, and he can tell this his own way because this is a secondhand story told to me, but Michael Start was in a... Michael, why don't you tell the story about the dance group that you were in?
About which one?
The dance group, when you would go and dance with kids.
Oh, National Dance Institute.
Yeah, because I think that story is important in the sense of, like, your experience as a white suburban child going into spaces and places where you were not the only... that you were essentially the only white kid there, but experiencing that and wanting to be in that diverse world, I think,
great.
Is really important.
That's a great
that's
example
for parents to do too.
That's a great example of things parents could do.
I would add two things about Mateo. One is, and for parents, one is we used to take pictures of black people and white people and show them to Mateo and say, "Tell us," when he was like three or four, and say, "Mateo, tell us the difference." He would never talk about race, their skin color. He would say, "That person has a mustache. That person has a mustache. That person is wearing a white shirt." And that person wearing a blue shirt, that person has hair, that person no hair. He said, "Okay, Mateo, what else? Like, okay, like get to the point." And he's like, "There is nothing else, Daddy, that's it."
Right.
Didn't see the difference of skin color. At a certain point in the past year and a half-ish, he's begun to understand that someone is black and someone is white, skin color. Taught that.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Someone taught him that. We taught him that, school.
Right.
TV, someone taught him that, right?
Right.
So once he gets taught that, then what does it mean? As part of the tour around the country this summer with students from March for Our Lives, we went to Standing Rock in North Dakota. Uh-huh. And I brought Mateo with me. Uh-huh. And he was on the tour with us. And we get to the tribal council building where they have their council meetings.
Yes.
And they're there to present to us in the most grandiose, beautiful fashion, a welcoming ceremony. And they're gifting us things and they're singing and they're dancing. And there's a whole bunch of kids in there, little ones, like 5, 6 year olds, and there's some teenagers and some elders and some adults. And we get into this beautiful tribal council room, and Mateo says to me, "Daddy, where are the Native Americans?" And I said, "They're right there." And he said, "No, they're not, Daddy. Those aren't Native Americans." And I was like, "What do you mean those aren't Native Americans?" And I was like, "Yeah, they live here. They're from Standing Rock." He's like, "No, Daddy, they're not wearing Native American stuff." Mm. And I was like, "Oh, what do you think they should be wearing?" He says, like feathers and Native American stuff.
Right.
So someone taught him that Native Americans only walk around the world in their traditional attire or their ceremonial attire. No one taught him that a five-year-old kid who was sitting next to him looked just like him in his attire, wearing sneakers and a hoodie and playing a video game on his mother's cell phone, was a Native American child. Mm. So that now Mateo knows that Native American people don't just wear a ceremonial or traditional attire, that they look just like him in the way they dress, at least in this country. So those conversations, and when I was a child, I had the great opportunity to work with National Dance Institute, which was Jacques D'Amboise, who's the great American ballet dancer, his nonprofit. And, you know, we would dance all over the city, and we'd be in Chinatown at some middle school on Saturday dancing and, you know, and rehearsing in Chinatown with, you know, a lot of, you know, Chinese American and children of Chinese immigrants and kids from the Lower East Side and the Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and like white kids from Upper East Side whose parents would bring them down to rehearse. And I had great parents, right? And so my parents were also able to process my questions when I would come home. Like, you know, it feels different to be a minority in this group. And I never felt that before. And like, why am I feeling this way? Because I've always felt part of the majority as a white kid. Mm. And so my parents, as progressive hippies and incredible minds that they are, were able to process that with a child. So as your child gets older, you know, certainly your child, Katie, but others who are listening, you know, these milestones, right? When your child starts to see color, like, you know, Howard Schultz said, you know, yesterday or recently that, you know, he doesn't see color. That is an absolute disservice to ending racism in this country, because of course we see color. Of course, my child at a young age sees that, you know, his cousin is a different skin, his first cousin, my brother's child, he married a black woman, is his first cousin, and that his aunt is black.
Right.
And he at a certain point understands there's a difference. And so what we've done is to say those differences are beautiful. Those differences are unique. And even, you know, he asked me the other day, I don't know if you know this, Paolo, but he asked me the other day, there is this man in the neighborhood who is a veteran of the war. He lost both of his legs. He walked around with prosthetics. And we saw him on the way to school. And we started talking to him. You know, he talks to everyone. He's a nice guy. And we started talking to him. And he asked me about, you know, losing his legs. And I explained to him. And there's another young, amazing 12-year-old, Jordan Reeves, who's out of Missouri, who's this amazing young girl who we got a chance to know. And she does this TED Talk where she takes this unicorn prosthetic on her arm because she only has half of her arm that she was born with. And she shoots glitter, right, out of her unicorn prosthetic. And Mateo knows her.
Wow.
And I said, Jordan, we love Jordan. Jordan's a cool kid. But Jordan was born a little bit different than you were born, but she's still just as cool as you are, right? So never trying to use race or gender or differences that your child might have from someone else as a way to compare, but like shower all of them with love. Like they, you know.
Yeah, but like it's like not ignoring that it's not there, because that's not how we get into this mess.
When you ignore it, someone else is going to tell your child that, you know, that kid's black.
Yeah, or that Native Americans only wear feathers. You know what I mean? It's like you can't. You guys, last question. Do you have, like, it's so amazing to me. I can't thank you enough for taking time. And I think this is so important for parents of new kids or even elementary school kids or whatever. Like, it's just never too late. And from this conversation, I've really learned it's never too early either to plant these seeds. Do you have advice for parents who feel like they're just out of depth on a lot of these big issues? Like, you know, because of your line of work and your passion, it comes so naturally and easy to you, I think, to really talk about these huge subjects. And I feel like a lot of parents I know are probably feel like they're ill-equipped to even have these conversations between each other. It's so sad. But they're kids, too. I mean, are there books or resources? And if you guys even take a few days and you think about them, I want to put anything you guys suggest or any advice on. We have crib notes that go along with the podcast for people who and can click on how can they feel like they can have these conversations with their kids? And, you know, I always go back to it's probably just honesty is best. Like, if I don't feel very great, you know, at talking about something and say, you know, mommy's not 100% confident, but this is what I think or this is what I feel. But do you have any advice to young parents who feel like they're out of their league?
Good luck.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I'll make mine very short. I've come to learn from mentors and elders in my life that the key to staying young, and all of us have tried our very best to stay young, is curiosity. Mm. And when you lose your curiosity, I believe you begin to get old. And your child or your children are so curious. They're curious creatures. They want to know everything. So join that journey with them. Mm. Right? Join that journey of curiosity. Don't think because they ask a question and you may not know the answer, you can't go find the answer, whether it's learning yourself or finding someone in your life who has a shared experience that you could bring and introduce to your child, whether it's LGBTQ member of that community, or it's a Black friend of yours who has, you know, can talk about their situation of being a Black person in America. But I learn every single day with our child. I can't wait till he gets homework that I can't do and have to figure out how to do long division again.
Oh God, I'm so screwed.
Yeah, those days are really exciting. But just stay curious. And as your child, you know, goes through his or her or their journey of curiosity, just join them in that journey and never judge that the child is doing it right, doing it wrong, going down the wrong course or the right course. Just like focus on that journey. And hopefully by the end of it, when it's all said and done, it's like you look up, you say, wow, that's really, really fun. And it's really beautiful. And yes, there were days that were tough. And yes, there were times that I didn't have the answers, but I loved it. I loved the learning. I loved the curiosity. I loved the challenges, because it not only made my child better, it actually made me better. Mm.
So helpful to me. And Paola, do you have anything to add to that?
You know, I would just say that it's not easy, because you said that like this it seems so natural and easy for us. And I don't necessarily think, I don't want it to seem as if these conversations are quote unquote easy. Mm-hmm. Because they're not in life, right? We're talking about race conversations. Race conversations between adults are not easy. And they shouldn't necessarily be easy with your child either, but we have to be brave enough to have them with our children, just like we have to be willing enough to have these conversations with when we're having them with adults. Because I think if we say that it's easy, then it makes it seem like it's not easy for others, it's like not right, which it's not. Like, it's not easy for me to talk about child separation with Mateo.
Right.
For a whole host of reasons. And so I think with regards to if you feel ill-equipped to have these conversations with your children, then how do you move forward with them? Children's books. There are a lot of children's books out there that are really, really great, that deal with tough subjects. You know, there's this one book called The Journey, that is a book essentially about being a refugee and what happens to a family when they're in a war-torn country and they move across the globe, across the world, in through various dangerous circumstances to come to another country. That book is really, really beautiful. And it opens up the conversation in a way that I think it guides you how to have this conversation around these very tough subjects with children. So I do think that there are many books like that that I would guide parents to give you kind of the boundaries as to how to have these conversations. And then with regards to educating themselves so parents can have a better understanding, you know, there's incredible people out there to read their books and to follow on social media. Dr. Brittany Cooper is amazing. Eloquent Rage is her most recent book, but anything by Dr. Brittany Cooper will blow your mind. She's a Black feminist who's just one of the most brilliant people that I know. She talks about race and she talks about gender and feminism and the intersection of all of those things. And it's incredible. Obviously, Rebecca Traister, her latest book, I think, will open anyone's mind with regards to feminism and where we are in this moment, and being enraged about it as well, and how movements have used rage as something to behold and to benefit them. And then I think also, just again, like for me, what I think has been, there's so much that lacks in general in the education of the American educational public school system. But I think one of the most detrimental things is that there isn't a lot of range and scope with regards to the literature that students are given in high school, but also in college. And myself as a story, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, as a writer, experiencing story through literature is a way in which to gain understanding from a human personal level. So I would tell people, and I tell this to a lot of people, go and read books by Latina writers in the United States, right? Go and read books by Native American writers and Black writers and Asian writers, and experience the world through their eyes in these novels, and start to understand what it means to be something other than a white man or a white woman in the United States. And I think that that will help parents be able to hopefully feel as if they have more tools with which to have these conversations.
Can I just say one last
thing? Oh my gosh,
thing,
please.
Before
I mean, let's
we
just
end,
talk all
I just
day.
Want to shower you with some praise for a minute, Katie. We have known Carrie Washington for many, many years, and certainly are big admirers of what she's done in her career, and not just in her career, but you know, in her work.
Yes.
And through that, had the chance to, you know, meet some of your cast members on Scandal and become good friends with Guillermo and Bellamy and others. You know, I've watched you, you know, certainly in your professional career as an actress, as an artist, but I do want to just, you know, shower you with love and praise for this, because using your platform in a time where parents really need to get support from each other, a lot of confusion, a lot of fear, a lot of joy, a lot of happiness, right, at the same time, I think to create this platform, and certainly no surprise that, you know, it's number one in this category, certainly because of you and also because of what you're talking about, right? And what people need to hear and want to hear and need the support along the way of raising your kid. As Paola just said, raising Mateo every day is my greatest challenge in life. It's my also greatest joy in life. And so thank you for using the platform you have been given after such an amazing television show to step up in this moment and share your vulnerabilities and share your fears and your joys and your happinesses with the world. I know your career obviously continues. I know you're doing Broadway. Thanks. You're doing a lot more great things. But this work is great for all parents to be able to have the access to. So thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you guys for taking the time. This has been so awesome and eye-opening, both of you. Michael, Paola, this is so inspiring, and I just, you know, of all the things I've done in my life, this is the podcast is the thing that most people stop me on the streets about, especially moms just, you know, really in need or feeling alone or feeling like they don't know what to do. And it's the most, to me, the most important work is raising a citizen of the world. And I just think you guys have added so much to this conversation for my family personally and for all of our listeners. So thank you so much for being guests on Katie's Crib.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paola. Thanks, Michael. Have a great day.
See you tonight.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Katie's Crib. Be sure to check out shondaland.com, where you can find every episode of Katie's Crib, and we've got crib notes for each episode where you can find out more about our guests and links to some of the resources we talk about on the podcast. And last, but definitely not least, subscribe. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, basically like wherever you get your podcasts.